Next, we'll meet a filmmaker whose mission is to broaden the scope of diversity shown on television and in the movies. As part of LGBT Pride Month, that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender, we turn to filmmaker Maurice Jamal, who's openly gay himself and is all about putting that community on the media map. You may have already seen some of Mr. Jamal's work. He's the man behind the 2007 film Dirty Laundry. It's a black and gay-oriented family film that was one of the first such movies released in theaters.
Do you realize how hard it was growing up around here? You know, feeling like I never was really a part of anything, or feeling like something was wrong with me.
I always raised my kids not to even care about what other people think.
Also, Mr. Jamal is featured in the book Black, Gifted, and Gay by Layla Farah that came out this past winter. He's with us now at NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Mr. Jamal, thanks for joining us. And can I call you Maurice?
Of course you can. You better. Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm great.
I want to start out by asking you, what made you decide that you wanted or needed to make films and television about the LGBT community?
Well, you know, I've always been a movie freak. I was that weird, awkward little kid that you had to pull from the big television set on a Saturday morning and make me go play outside because I just wanted to watch old films. And so for me, I've always wanted to work in the industry. That's always been what I wanted to do ever since I was a little kid, and started out acting and then writing and directing for theater, and then moved on to a film career. And I think for me, my first feature film was a film called The Ski Trip, and it was this romantic comedy, and it was about this gay couple. I played one of the characters. And, you know, I didn't necessarily start out wanting to just make films or make stories about the LGBT community. It's just that as a writer, it just seemed a little disingenuous for me to write a Julia Roberts film and I'm substituting my relationship drama for hers. So I just kind of wrote what I knew, and I wrote about the people who were around me, and I wrote about the circumstances that I had been in. And part of me sort of knew or felt that people really just like good entertainment. They love good stories. They love a good romance. They love a good drama. And it doesn't necessarily matter if the people look just like you or if their lifestyles are like yours, if they can relate to it.
I'm interested that you brought up Ski Trip because I seem to remember when that movie came out, you were already talking to friends about whether or not to come out publicly as gay. And then something happened at the movie screening that made that decision for you. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, most definitely. You know, I was working with a collective group of filmmakers, and we were looking at new ways of how to make films. And so Ski Trip was our first feature experiment. We shot it in 10 days for about $12,000. I always say the only reason I was able to do that is because I was ignorant. And I was drinking a lot of espressos at the time. And, you know, there's a term in our community, straight privilege. And I recognize that I benefited from a certain amount of straight privilege.
What does that mean?
Straight privilege is basically, in the gay and lesbian community, folks who can pass.
You mean, you know, pass as straight?
Yeah, if I don't say too much, if I use neutral pronouns when I'm talking about my partner, people don't necessarily know for sure that I'm gay. And so being young, being black, being a member of the hip-hop community, a lot of my friends were like, Maurice, don't come out. Stay in the closet, even though you've made this gay film, because it's going to be tough on you. And I remember, you know, we were at the premiere of this film, and a gentleman stood up and asked me why I made the film. And I was talking about the fact that I like romantic comedies and I wanted to do something really cool. And he was like, no, brother. He's like, what I mean is, as a straight black man, why did you make this film about gay boys? And that made it really cut and dry for me. And I recognized that I had a choice. I either was going to live my life or I was going to live someone else's. And I decided I needed to live my life. So I remember taking a really deep breath and saying, well, actually, as a gay black man, you know, and then there were gasps and oohs and ahs. And that was really sort of it. So that was sort of my professional coming out.
If you're just joining us, I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with black and openly gay filmmaker Maurice Jamal. His movies and television programming focus on the LGBT community. I wonder if you find it difficult to walk a line between the African-American gay, lesbian, transgender, and bi community, and the rest of the community, because there are some that might feel there's been some friction between the two sides.
You know, there definitely is. I'll be honest with you. The difficulty I've had on some level is all internal. meaning it's the struggles that I deal with as a black man of making sure that I'm a good, respectable, upstanding black man and that I'm doing something positive in our community. But what I had to recognize is if there are people in our community who aren't supporting LGBT issues, who aren't in favor of equality, who can't really talk about gender and sexuality diversity, those folks are actually the ones who are doing a disservice to our community, and not someone like me or the other people in the LGBT community who are living their lives honestly and with integrity. And so for me, I don't have a problem walking that line right now because I almost don't even perceive that there is a line. For me, it's about living my life. It's about creating amazing art that inspires people. It's about telling stories with honesty and integrity. And if I do that, then whatever side of the line folks fall on is okay with me.
Maurice, let me ask you a political question. President Obama's reelection campaign is hosting a fundraising gala with the LGBT community in New York City next week. I'm curious as to how you think he is handling that community's issues. I mean, and your Glow TV section about your website, you have a section called A Message from the President, and no, we don't mean Barack Obama. So this might make us think you're displeased, are you?
No, not really. I mean, that was more of a joke because everybody at the network always refers to me as the president. So it was just sort of a running joke of ours. I actually think that the president's done a pretty stand-up job in dealing with the gay and lesbian community. I know over the last year or so, there have been some conversations and there have been some critiques from some of our major organizations, most of which I'm members of, in reference to the president and how he's handled the gay community. But, you know, he has done more in the 2 years of his presidency than all of the previous administrations have done combined. And I remember the night of the election when he won and sitting on the couch crying. I'd voted for him. I was a big supporter. And when he mentioned gays and lesbians in his speech on election night, I knew that we were in for something different. Are all of his policies perfect? No. I would push and challenge the president around marriage equality because I think it's a fundamental issue, and I think it's a moral issue in this country, and I think that people who are on the side of marriage equality are on the right side.
Maurice, let me ask you, and that so far with the 2012 Republican presidential race beginning to shape up, are there any people from the Republican Party that you think have been supportive of your community?
I would say no. The reality is they're just on the wrong side of these issues. They have been traditionally and they continue to be. And unfortunately, you know, I just watched the Republican debate in New Hampshire the other evening and all of the candidates pandered to the social conservatives on this issue. They talked about defensive marriage. I mean, we hear them talking about that. When you hear them talk about women's rights, when you hear them talk about abortion and education, it's just amazing how far right I think the Republican Party has pivoted. And that's unfortunate because there used to be a number of people in that party whose opinions I respected, even if I disagreed with them.
Maurice, in the really short time we have left, I just want to ask whether you hope that your programming could maybe have a greater impact on LGBT policy and issues by allowing people to get a clearer glimpse of what's happening in the community.
Definitely. I mean, I certainly, you know, we hope that the GLOW programming reaches those individuals who are making change. But if I could say one thing, Allison, it would be that change actually comes from individuals. And so if the programming on GLOW allows a kid in Oklahoma to recognize that he's okay, if it allows a lesbian college student somewhere in New York City or New Jersey to recognize that she's got the ability and that she has a voice and that people support her, those individuals are going to begin to demand change. Because when we have pride in ourselves, when we recognize ourselves, when we see ourselves reflected in film and television in loving and positive and honest ways and with integrity, we can't help but then realize that there's things that we can do, and we begin to take accountability for making the change in our communities.
Maurice, I'm sorry, we've got to leave it there. Maurice Jamal is a filmmaker and the founder and president of GLOW TV, an urban LGBT online television network. He joined us from NPR member station KQED in San Francisco, California. Thanks so much. And
thank you,
good
Allison.
Luck to you with your network.
Thank you, love. I appreciate it.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Channel 101 in Los Angeles isn't a TV station. It's a monthly underground gathering where do-it-yourself video makers share a little homemade programs. It's been going strong since 2003, and alumni have gone on to jobs with Saturday Night Live, Adult Swim, and Funny or Die. Noah Nelson went to the downtown independent movie theater to check out the scene.
Channel 101 is known for its offbeat humor. What's different is the norm for these shows made in backyards, small apartments, and occasionally convenience stores. In this live-action riff on Alvin and the chipmunks on screen are played by real iguanas.
All right, you chipmunks. Hey, Simon.
The iguanas star in tonight's episode of the series Everything and get a lot of laughs from the mostly 20-something crowd. You'd be hard-pressed to find someone texting. After all, the filmmaker is probably sitting next to them. Here's another show from tonight's lineup, Gigglers. It's a sitcom about two crash-landed alien girls whose only form of communication is giggling. That may sound out there, and it is.
That booming noise in the woods last night? That was them crash-landing from space.
Look! Antenna! And you're the lucky best friend that gets to find out.
Gigglers was submitted by Callie Fontecchio, who has been coming to Channel 101 since August.
This is actually the first screening where I actually have a show in the lineup, so it's very exciting.
And nerve-wracking, says Fontecchio.
Because you're actually in a room full of your peers who all make shows exactly like you do and whom you respect on a very, like, high level.
And for good reason. The two guys who started it have big TV careers now. Dan Harmon is the creator of the sitcom Community, and Rob Schraub directs series like Parks and Recreation. The two friends moved out to Los Angeles together from Wisconsin over a decade ago. Harmon says that the spark for 101 came while they were writing a TV pilot directed by Ben Stiller.
Ben Stiller gave Rob one of these new Sony DV hand cams. It was an incredible explosion for us, and it coincided with our first huge, gigantic professional failure.
That pilot never aired, but they started making handycam shorts just to make each other laugh. Soon they were throwing parties where their friends would share their own shorts. In the era before YouTube, those parties outgrew the living rooms where they began and moved to bigger venues. Schraub says their agent pushed them to be more selective with what was screened.
Because there were ones that were 15 minutes long that were just awful, just really terrible.
And so there's no way we're going to start saying what's best and what's not,
yeah.
Because then it's just... We've already learned that the geniuses of yesterday are the tyrants of today, and we've suffered that fate.
As Harmon puts it, they were too afraid to be the ones to make brutal cuts. They wanted to pass that responsibility on to someone they could trust.
So Rob said, what if we put the audience in charge?
Channel 101 is a democracy where the audience votes. Of the 10 shows that screen, only 5 make the cut to return the next month. That kind of rejection is familiar to Brennan Campbell, who began submitting to 101 and getting rejected again and again while he still lived in Indiana.
It's really brutal. You get rejected a lot. The audience might not vote you back. And I think that really helps people who are selling real TV shows and working in the industry because you get so used to rejection. You're immune to it after a while.
The rejection is a rite of passage. And after the show, everyone gathers on the roof of the movie theater to celebrate or soften the blow. That's the secret sauce of Channel 101. Anything goes. And it's okay to fall flat on your face. The rest of the comedy nerds and film freaks in the not-quite-secret club will be waiting for you afterwards, ready to see what you cook up next. For NPR News, I'm Noah Nelson in Los Angeles.
Noah Nelson is a reporter for Turnstile News, a project of Youth Radio.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy?
You probably know the song, an instant hit on its release in 1975, reborn when Freddie Mercury died, revived by a carload of head-banging slackers in Wayne's World. It's Queen's opera-inspired Bohemian Rhapsody, back in the spotlight again. It's been named the UK's favorite pop song ever by listeners of the BBC.
I'm just a poor boy. I need no
The meaning and inspiration behind Bohemian Rhapsody has been debated for decades. Music writer Alan Connor, who's also a freelancer for the BBC, joins us now from London with his own interpretation. Thanks so much for being with us.
What a pleasure to be with you to talk about this song.
Let's listen to the verse where people can begin to get just a little, begin to scratch our heads.
I see a little silhouette of a man. Scaramouche, Scaramouche, will you do the fandango? Thunderbolt and lightning, very, very frightening me. Galileo,
Okay, Scaramouche, Fandango, Galileo.
Magnifico.
Why, is it just like nice nonsense words, as it would be in a children's story, Dr. Seuss or something?
I don't think so. I think you can kind of look at each of the odd words, and I think they make sense in context. Scaramouche is a stock character from the 16th century Italian art form Commedia dell'arte, which is a boastful character who's ultimately put down and humiliated by the other characters. So if you listen to that middle section as a trial, the central character who's killed the person is being yelled at and humiliated by these strange singing judges.
While we're speaking of Freddie Mercury, I guess I didn't know until just a few moments ago that he was Parsi, born in Zanzibar.
Yeah.
Which could explain another lyric, right?
He was of Parsi heritage, and one of the other nice-sounding words in there is Bismillah, which is an Arabic way of invoking God's name and asking him to intervene. So it's a word that Freddie would have been familiar with from his upbringing, and I would say it fits again in the song. He's saying, oh, my God, help me.
Well, why do you think the song endures after all these years?
The main thing about it is it's sheer sonic bombast. There's so many parts to it that you're bound to have a favourite bit, whether it's the kind of head-banging bit or the opera or the quiet bits at the start and the end. Nothing really matters,
anyone can see. Alan Connor, music writer, speaking with us from London. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Nothing really matters to me.
This is NPR News.